He titled his study, The First Four Notes. That's how significant Matthew Guerrieri believes the da-da-da-dum that opens Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 is. And he opens that book with two stories concerning the power of that work as a whole. He tells us, Jean-François Le Sœur was not quite sure what to make of Beethoven's Fifth. Le Sœur was a dramatic composer, a specialist in oratorios and operas, and the Parisian taste for such fare had persisted from the reign of Louis XVI through the Revolution, through Napoleon, through the Restoration. For audiences suddenly to be whipped into a frenzy by instrumental music, as they were in 1828, when a new series of orchestral concerts brought Paris its first sustained dose of Beethoven's symphonies, was something curious. Le Sœur, nearing 70, was too refined to fulminate, but he kept a respectful distance from the novelties. That is, until one of his students, an up-and-coming enfant terrible named Hector Berlioz, dragged his teacher to a performance of the Fifth Symphony. Berlioz later recalled Le Sœur's post-concert reaction. "Oh, I'm going outside. I need some air. It's unbelievable, wonderful. It so moved and disturbed me and turned me upside down that when I came out of my box and went to put on my hat, for a moment, I didn't know where my head was." Alas, in retrospect, it was too much of a shock. At his lesson the next day, Le Sœur cautioned Berlioz that, all the same, that sort of music should not be written. Guerrieri continues, in 1920, Stefan Volpe, then an 18-year-old student at the Berlin Hochschule für Musik, organized a Dadaist provocation. He put 8 phonographs on a stage, each bearing a recording of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. He then played all 8 simultaneously, with each record turning at a different speed. A socialist and a Jew, Volpe would flee Nazi Germany. He eventually ended up in America, cobbling together a career as an avant-garde composer and as a teacher whose importance and influence belied his lack of fame. The jazz saxophonist Charlie Parker, shortly before he died, approached Volpe about lessons and a possible commission piece. In a 1962 lecture, Volpe recalled his Dada years, revisiting his Beethoven collage for the audience. In a bow to technological change, though, this performance used only 2 phonographs at the once familiar 33 and a third and the 78 RPM settings. Volpe then spoke of one of the early Dada obsessions or interests, namely the concept of unforeseeability, saying, "That means that every moment events are so freshly invented, so newly born, that it has almost no history in the piece itself, but its own actual presence." If today we regard Le Sœur's frazzled confusion upon hearing Beethoven's Fifth as unusual, it is at least in part because of the subsequent ubiquity of the Fifth Symphony. The music's immediacy has been forever dented by its celebrity. Volpe's eightfold distortion can be heard as a particularly outrageous attempt to recreate Le Sœur's experience of the Fifth, to conjure up a time when the work's course was still unforeseeable. It is an uphill battle. In the 2 centuries since its 1808 premiere, Beethoven's Fifth has become so familiar that it is next to impossible to recreate the disorientation that it could cause when it was newly born. Words of Matthew Guerrieri from his study, The First Four Notes, laying out the reality he sees, that Symphony No. 5 by Beethoven has more or less lost its power to overwhelm us, as it clearly did with its first audiences. It's fascinating that composer Joo-won Kim tells a story from his childhood that echoes, in a way, what we've just heard about Le Sueur and Volpe. Juwan will never forget that when he was still a child, he sat and listened to Symphony No. 5 by Beethoven in its entirety. He tells us he was totally gripped by the music. And yet, as he grew and entered his own musical life, Juwan found that the whole enterprise of classical music and its presentation had grown stale. And like Volpe, he tweaked the noses of his professors, but all in his search for a new and fresh way to create and present music that would grab listeners as he was gripped as a child, transfixed, perhaps. And the results are quite stunning. His piece titled Beethoven on Struggle is an example.
Got no words about how we got a verse around the world, the same song, but now I got a verse. While the streets holler, a corpse sleeps out of her soul. Shit is me, why my dreams gotten burst. Need to be where we need not, keep dodging blurbs, thoughts of me shot, bleeding on.
Remember Le Sueur and his hat? Maybe we want to hold on to ours, or not. Juwan Kim has developed a special way of working and innovating. And he and his friends and colleagues who understand his passion for music and for reaching listeners in profound ways have become part of the hip-hop orchestra experience. He's developed, in fact, something he titles method sampling, and we'll learn more as we have a conversation with Juwan Kim. Because Abigail Manns, director of performing arts at Commonwealth University Bloomsburg, recognized something distinctive and real in Juwan Kim and his experience, she's arranged for the hip-hop orchestra experience under the artistic direction of composer and pianist Juwan Kim to perform in the Haas Center for the Arts on Saturday, March 1st at 7:30 p.m. We had a chance to speak by phone with Juwan Kim and Abby Manns in anticipation of the performance to learn more.
Arts in Bloom, we're located at Commonwealth University Bloomsburg, so we work to program for our in-house music department as well as the theater and dance department and faculty and staff in the local community. So obviously that's a lot of different people that we're programming for, so we do all kinds of different things. We do music, we do dance, we do theater shows, all of the above. But particular interest in Juwan and Ensemble McNawooj and the Hip Hop Orchestra, because it's different and it's new. It combines things that we don't typically see combined. And I like the whole idea, the whole method sampling thing really resonated with me, that if you want to make change and have a sustainable organization or group or whatever, you need to try something new. Like, we can't keep doing the same things that we've been doing. And I thought that this really leaned into that. And additionally, one of our former students and alumni worked closely with Juwan in doing the first documentary, method sampling. So Josh Nesmith, he's from the Harrisburg area, was a student here, worked for me during his time as a student, very talented, lovely human being. So we're happy to be able to also, in conjunction with this, feature his work as well.
And so, Juwan, that's nice that you're coming to a place where someone you've worked with has worked creatively. That tells us something about Jason Nesmith. When he was still a young artist, he was doing work right here with you, Abby. We know something about you, Juwan. When you were a young artist, we learned that you came at 20 and studied at Berkeley, but I wonder what you were doing up until your 20s. Were you playing classical piano? What were you listening to in those youthful days when you were young, Juwan?
Well, I think subconsciously, I wanted to be a composer when I was 12, actually when I was 10. It was then I had listened to Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in one sitting. Where I was just, I don't know why that happened, but I just listened to that piece and I couldn't really get out of it. And later found out that he was deaf and then wrote that piece of music. So I was wondering how he had done it and what kind of training that he had gone through to create such a cohesive piece. And I was definitely hooked. And during my puberty times, I really wanted to do music and I wanted to specifically be a composer. And I decided to be a composer at that moment. And it was during the time that I spent in my undergrad that I sort of got fed up with the concert music aesthetic, where I felt like a lot of efforts were made in terms of, quote, unquote, creating new language of music, almost in the vacuum of public sort of interaction. And I felt like language of music or language in general should be practiced in the world. And if you look at something like even Esperanto, when it goes to the second and third generation, the first generation and third generation language is completely different thing. They can't really communicate with each other. And in the sense that I found more sort of organic development in pop music and jazz especially. So I started writing this kind of music as like a protest against sort of academic approach to composition. And had a breakthrough when I listened to NWA, because I have no context of hip-hop music. I just wrote it as like, oh, what would really bother the teachers, right? So I wrote this piece that had, you know, chamber group, like Pierre Ensemble type chamber group, new music setting, and then had an MC and a drummer. And indeed, that bothered the teachers very much, but also really made the audience love the music. And I ended up getting a full-page write-up in a very respected media outlet. So at that time, I realized I had to kind of like explore what has been done. And even more so because my MC thought that I should make an album with him. So I wrote an hour of music, spending like 6 months writing it. And I thought, like, what did I do? I should really get into hip hop. And I started taking hip hop in a very sort of respectful way. So the way I would approach like 20th century compositions, even if I didn't understand it, I would go listen to it and try to figure out why I didn't like it, why I liked it, and then move on to the next one and have a critical view of it. So during the course of approaching hip hop that way, I encountered NWA, and I felt like I was dipped into the river of hip hop and reborn as free musician.
That's like an epiphany in the large sense. You know the phrase, scales falling from one's eyes. Well, this, pardon the pun, scales falling from your ears.
Yeah, I mean, it changed my life.
And you help us understand there's something about the rhythm, right? Now, Beethoven, we know Symphony No. 7 with that propulsion and that rhythmic drive to the end of the symphony. But were you not attracted to the rhythm of hip-hop?
It was like a combination of rhythm and the content of what they were saying, because it takes a specific, special audacity to say what they were saying, especially in the time of NWA when they were talking about police brutality, because there was no cell phone, there was no anything, but they would say it anyways. It was that kind of like courage that I was really interested in. And I felt it was analogous to what Beethoven was doing, because I don't think Eroica was received really well when it was premiered. So for me, much like even Smells Like Teen Spirit, Nirvana. They didn't know anything about music, meaning they didn't write it down. But how did that music affect people so much? That was my sort of point. Because if you are studying and then you're thinking that you're creating this new musical language and then that's going to translate to the public, which is what the Second Viennese School thought, and they really literally thought that by them doing this 12-tone music, it would be converted into, I don't know, Kesha singing in 12-tone, which never happened. But then all this pop music and African-American music in general was translating to the world. And I wanted to know how that worked. And I think it's much more of an attitude. And then the structure happens afterwards. The theory happens afterwards. Music happens first. So that's what I realized.
And you're very much a deep thinker. You ask very important questions like you've laid out for us in that way. Why does this happen? Why does this work? And you actually refer to a critical theory philosopher as part of someone whose work you wrestled with. How does that work in, or do you have to go to method sampling and then tell us about how the philosopher fits in?
Yeah, so method sampling is something that I kind of coined later as I was explaining what I was doing. So it basically came out something like this. Like when I first started writing this kind of music, I decided to replicate hip-hop music only using classical techniques and thinking that, okay, then I can make Kanye West beats using only classical instrument and only classical techniques. What ended up happening was neither hip-hop nor classical. So then I wondered, interesting, because I think that there's something to this, and kind of suddenly had an awakening about, hey, I think maybe all innovation works this way. In order for any innovation to happen, perhaps we need to have foreign element coming in and replacing portions of it. And by doing so, it actually triggers innovation. So we have a bold claim that all innovation only happens through method sampling. So far, it held up. And because of this kind of, I don't want to say philosophy, because I think that philosophy is also kind of dead in a way, just like how classical composition is dead, as in, I'm going to contextualize it, as in that philosophers, the questions that they're asking were answered by psychology, answered by neuroscience. So in a similar way, composition became weaker. So there are other producers that are creating fulfilling music for other people. So I was thinking about ways to explain the innovation and the change of the world. And obviously, the change of the world would come after having something new coming forward, emerging forward, right? So these questions were sort of bothering me. So I kind of connected with some thinkers that I respected, and they were thinking that this was an interesting idea. And when we asked Fabio Bighi to be on this film, he was very glad to be asked and decided to be part of it.
You did that already. You tried to do classical and hip-hop, and it was neither the way you described it. So what does working with classical instruments, you know them well, what does the sound of the French horn or the exquisite singer bring when you mix it in with someone who is speaking words of truth? Where does the synergy take place?
Well, that's a very heavy question. I think it all comes down to the music that I write is what I write, right? So it's up to the people to decide whether this is good or profound or bad or however. But a lot has to do with the MCs and how flexible they are, how sort of real student and masters of rhyme they are, as in, you know, these compositions that I'm writing have like odd meters and meter changes within the phrase, which never happens in hip-hop. And then they're often in 3/4 and then have like interludes inserted in the middle of the piece, in the beginning of the piece, and ends with the instrumental epilogue. And so that makes it totally structurally not hip-hop, which is generally in 16-bar phrase, and there's like song form-ish thing going on. And I'm writing it as if I'm writing like a new music piece in some ways. So, you know, by it in itself, it creates a unique challenge for the MCs to really focus on the rhyming ability. And in doing so, they are pushed into this unknown waters. And if they can swim there, it's going to be amazing. Because I'm giving them all these like obstacles. They're like jumping through this fire and stuff like that. So the audience, when they see that, they'll feel like, oh gosh, I don't need to subscribe to certain subculture that hip hop is, I don't know, like secondarily related. You are just looking at the craft of writing and then the actual performance of the composition.
And what about the mixing in of the dance element? What about the dance element that comes to be part of what you've done?
So The idea for this particular iteration, Hip Hop Orchestra Experience, was like our effort to imitate how hip hop came out of in underground New York parties. At first, hip hop wasn't really about rhyming at all. It was actually about DJing and dancing. So dance element was very, very strong in hip hop. And we decided to actually incorporate that and then create this experience that is not necessarily, you know, like certain legacy acts doing their song with a big-ass orchestra. It was something like, how can we actually make it, how can we go back to the source and connect with that kind of creative atmosphere so that people can understand this is a truly new thing. It's not really classical music, but it's also rigorous. And look at the dancer who actually is doing something incredible. Because breakdance in general did not have any kind of prescribed notion at the time. They needed to just outdo each other. So they developed these techniques, which is incredible to me. So the particular dancer that we work with, Young Phil, just did a performance with Kendrick Lamar at Super Bowl. And he practices what they call turf dancing, which came out of Oakland. And you'll see sort of ballet-like movement that they sample. You'll see some contortion. He actually, like, dislocates his shoulders. All this stuff is happening. And then background is orchestral music.
You have used the phrase deconstructing Beethoven, deconstructing Mozart. You've referred to the Coriolan Overture by Beethoven. I don't mean to keep going back to Beethoven, but it's pretty neat that when you were so young, you sat there and listened to the whole Beethoven Symphony 5. So it hasn't left you.
No, it hasn't left me. I think Beethoven is my, I mean, those big three, that's where I'm always going back to. I like, you know, the older guys too. I like Palestrina. I like some other Renaissance people, but those are my three, basically like Holy Trinity.
And you've named them Beethoven, Mozart, and Bach.
Yes. So as for deconstruction, it is part human variation. It is part, you know, how hip-hop people sample and then build a new piece. So you will hear direct quotation, but then I'll change it as if I'm a producer using the material to sort of build a new piece.
It would seem that there would be other composers who are interested in what you're doing.
So as for other composers, I can't really tell you who that might be. I mean, there's a guy that's a grandson of Prokofiev, Gabriel Prokofiev in UK. He's trying to do something like that, but it generally doesn't work. The way they do it, it's almost like they're trying to make concert music out of hip-hop. And I didn't try to do that. I actually did the opposite because I knew that normal composers would actually treat it like ethnomusicology. They would like sample stuff like Bartok style and try to make some concert music. I decided to do exactly the opposite. I tried to make hip-hop music using only classical techniques. What ended up happening was interesting. What I liked, though, is a piece by Max Richter. He did like sort of like a deconstruction of Vivaldi. And that's a very powerful piece. I think the process is very similar. I don't know whether he did it consciously, but I think that is an example of method sampling.
It sounds like you have a coterie of people you work with, like the dancer and like your good friend Christopher, maybe, and the musicians you play with. Is it pretty much a stable group of people who understand what you're doing and they want to work with you and explore what you're doing with you?
Yes. I do have core crew because it's difficult for us to find the right kind of person that's really talented, really talented dancer, somebody who gets the vision of it and then actually want to try it. Because a lot of times people want to stay in their lane, especially now that everything has been siloized in a way. And I think that what we do is actually break these kind of boundaries in a comfortable way. And that goes for the audience, too. They are surprisingly, pleasantly surprised that what they were expecting isn't happening on the stage, but at the same time, they like it even more. Because a lot of times when quote-unquote hip-hop orchestra thing happens, they generally use orchestra as like a cosmetic element, and it is generally superfluous. And what we are doing is not that at all.
Isn't that exciting, Abby, when you hear it all laid out like that?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I want to just point out one of the reasons that this program struck me in particular was because it's not one thing or the other. And like Juwan said, it's not siloed. So it creates an open space for the students and the community to explore something different and see they don't have to fit into one particular genre or like one particular thing. They can do all these different things and create something completely new and different. So that's one of the reasons I was interested in this.
And can you tell us the particulars, how we can take part, how we can get to experience the experience?
Sure. If you go to bloomu.universitytickets.com, and if they go there, they can click and buy tickets to the show, which is happening on March 1st, Saturday, March 1st at 7:30 p.m. in Haas Center for the Arts, Petrani Hall.
Maybe I'll save you a seat at the table where I break bread, making a speech, saying peace to the lovers.
Abigail Manns, Director of Performing Arts and Arts in Bloom at Commonwealth University, Bloomsburg, and Juwan Kim, composer and pianist, speaking about the appearance of the Hip Hop Orchestra Experience this Saturday, March 1st at 7:30 p.m. in Haas Center for the Arts on the Bloomsburg campus. For more information, on the web, bloomu.edu/arts-in-bloom. bloomu.edu/arts-in-bloom.
A culprit from the culprits, power broker and xenophobes, misleading the voters, fear mongering theologians speaking in the pulpit. Whoa, need to hold us close, we need to hold us close. Coast to coast, these boys, they want to get us to go.
Part concert, part dance party, we get a chance to experience the bridging of genres and the magnetic scores by Juwan Kim, the powerful rhymes by MC Unity Lewis, who works with George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars, and as we heard Juwan describe it, the striking turf dance by Young Phil, who was just at the Super Bowl performing with Kendrick Lamar, and all that supported by a 25-piece chamber orchestra featuring flute, oboe, clarinet, French horns, bassoons, strings, piano, and drums. The Hip Hop Orchestra Experience, part of the Arts in Bloom season at the Commonwealth University Bloomsburg, and that's Saturday, March 1st at 7:30 p.m. in Haas Center for the Arts. For more information, on the web, bloomu.edu/arts-in-bloom.
My pops was a veteran and a functioning drunk too. Funny as a child, the conclusions that you come to. Try to gather your senses, find some shit to numb you.